You're listening to Radio Psi Global Harmony Asia Stream. And the time now in our studios, dear listeners, is 12:30. And so this being a beautiful Thursday afternoon, as always, as it happens every Thursday, you're being joined by me, Prem, from Team Radio Psi. And with me is Arvind. And both of us offer our most humble and loving salutations at Bhagwan's lotus feet. And we welcome all of you to today's afternoon satsang. Welcome to you, Arvind, too.
Sai Ram, Prem. And as always, it is another warm afternoon, and the warmth is not only because of Bhagwan's love but also due to the summer that has descended with all its might in Puttaparthi. And this used to be the time when Bhagwan used to have the summer showers in Vrindavan or in...
And this also used to be the rumor time in Prashanthi Nilayam.
Yes, trying to find out when is Bhagwan leaving to Kodaikanal, right. When is... It, of course... elicits a lot of memories.
And I remember once, and somebody went and asked Swami, Swami, when are you going to Vrindavan? And Swami said, I don't know. Yeah. Ask the elderly ladies who sit in the corner.
Yes. There are different versions to the story. Somebody had told me once that Swami said, you ask the taxi drivers outside, they seem to know my plans better than myself.
Right. And on one occasion, I remember Swami said, not even my robe knows what I'm planning next.
That is true. That is definitely true.
That is really a very profound statement. And really, there is nobody who can be close to Swami by physically being close to Swami. And that was the message Swami was giving there.
No, if we examine Swami's life from his childhood till the physical last days, I don't think anybody could say that, I know how Swami thinks, I know how Swami works, I know how Swami does things. The minute you feel that you have got grasp over some aspect of Swami's life, the next moment, he does something that totally shatters all your theories, all your concepts. That has been Swami's life, because I don't think we can predict God, and that is why he always used to say, you must learn to love my uncertainty.
Really? And on one occasion Swami made the statement, Swami said, proximity was always comfort. Never think you can come close to me or you can earn that.
I remember one of our seniors who is currently, one among the youth at Hyderabad.
Right.
Yeah, he, when, in the hostel language, the term form boy is used to a student with whom Swami interacts regularly.
Right.
So he was one such form boy, and he had had many interactions with Bhagwan, many interviews. After that, we saw that Swami had a fall, and then Swami began to withdraw physically.
Right.
So on one occasion when he got a chance, a rare chance it was, because what used to be quite easy for him before, to speak to Swami on a physical level, had become very tough because of the circumstances. So he told Swami, when Swami lowered the glass door of his car door, he went and told Swami, Swami, you have moved so far away from us. The proximity that we had is no longer there. At that time also, Swami said the same thing that you said, he said that nobody ever had any proximity to me. Proximity was always given. And even today, to those whom I wish to give, they still are getting it. So, what we think of the Lord and what the Lord actually is are often very, very, very far apart from each other.
There's another beautiful analogy which one of my teachers in school used to say, and I had the opportunity to tell this even in the radio before, but I think it's quite perfect to narrate it now, and also as a lead on to our discussion for today. And she used to tell about the pre-independence days in Kolkata. They used to have these hawaldars, these local policemen, used to wear that baggy short pant, and they used to have these night duties in which they used to carry a peculiar looking lantern.
Okay.
A lantern which used to be covered on three sides with some material so that the light doesn't go out. And it almost used to work as a torch, an improvised torch.
Correct.
So if a person carries such a lantern and shows the light on your face, he will be able to see your face, but you will not be able to see who's holding the lantern.
Naturally.
Right? So they used to go around on rounds in the streets to see if anybody is laying on the road or any... activity which is worth inquiring into. So she used to tell that this Hawaldar, when he comes and shows this to you, you will not be able to see his face, and if you want to see his face, you have to request, may I know who's holding this lantern? And if that person turns that lantern towards himself, then you will be able to see his face.
Hmm.
And this teacher of mine used to tell that with God also is the same way.
Hmm.
He said, God can see everything of you.
Hmm.
God knows you in and out. But if you want to know God, you can do nothing but request Him to show Himself to you.
Very
and
nice.
It is when God turns His grace in such a way that He reveals Himself to you. And that is when you can actually know God.
Many have been the people who have attempted to describe Swami's glory, Swami's stories. It reminds me of an episode that happened to our revered Sri Kasturi,
okay.
who is been regarded as the official biographer of Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba.
Right.
Even in that case, it was not the case of Kasturi, who is actually, he's a master. He knew multiple languages. He's a great linguist. He was with the All India Radio. He has been a playwright. He has written dramas, novels. He's a great literary figure. Even to a person of his caliber, it was not possible to fathom Swami's glory and Swami's story. In fact, if you remember, we had discussed it before, how it was when Sri Kasturi first met Swami.
Right.
He had gone and it was at a devotee's house, and they were seated there along with the other devotees who was waiting, and they knew that Swami would be walking and then picking up people for an interview. So Kasturi was hoping secretly that he also gets picked, because he was very curious. And reading the book Loving God, you come to know of some incidents that happened before this so-called wait, which actually had made Kasturi very eager to meet Swami. Swami indeed picked him. He picked him and took him in. And he had got to know Swami through an alliance that had come for his daughter. So that was his connection. So he felt that he would be a...
There's one Mr. Potti Shastri.
Correct, Potti Iyer.
Potti Iyer, okay. Kasturi was interested in...
So Parmeshwar Iyer.
Right.
So, interested in for his daughter.
Right.
He felt that he will only have a secondary role in this interview, because he is not the, you know,
he
main
devotee.
He is just a acquaintance of the devotee going to become a family member of the devotee through this marriage. But Swami actually took Kasturi into the private interview room, and one-on-one, the first statement Swami ever told Kasturi is that you will be my biographer, you will write my Jeeva Charitra. In Kannada he told him. And Kasturi was just flabbergasted, he was just shocked. He felt that, first of all, you know, this is the first time I'm meeting him, I'm not even a devotee, and there are so many others who are pining to get to know him. But that is the master plan, you know. And if we look back today, the first four parts of the Satyam Shivam Sundaram have been so beautifully penned. By the way, Satyam Shivam Sundaram is the name of Swami's biography,
right,
that has been authored by Sri Kasturi, and the name also was given by Swami. And the story was, actually when Kasturi was told this, he just fell at Swami's feet, and he said, Swami, this is a great honor, great privilege that you're conferring, but let me confess that I won't be able to do it. Because, Swami, I don't know, I have come late. In 1948, Kasturi is telling Swami, I have come late, so I have missed so many things, I don't know. Swami said, you don't worry. I will send the right people to you, I will send you to the right people from where you can get the stories, and you will be writing it. I mean, that was the genesis of Satyam Shivam Sundaram, Swami's story. Even when it comes to, you know, writing his story, that too is so totally dependent on him. The instrument, everything, he's totally in control. And as you say, I mean, as we said, no way that we can fathom.
Yeah, really, the beauty is the story has to be revealed by him and him alone.
Hmm.
And even people who might have been eyewitnesses and were with him might have missed the major part of the story. In fact, there's a very interesting episode in the life of Tulsidas.
Hmm.
You know, when he begins to write the Ramayana much later, after the Ramayana actually happened, the blessing that he has is the whole scene of the Ramayana appears in front of his eyes as he narrates it.
Hmm.
Just similar to what Valmiki was promised when he began to write the Ramayana.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this particular incident when, you know, he writes about the scene when in Ashokvana Sita is seated and Hanuman goes there as an emissary of Lord Rama.
Okay.
Right? You know, that is when he describes the Ashokvana.
Hmm.
He says there were these trees, there were these gardens, and at one particular point he says there were beautiful white flowers.
okay.
around the place where Sita sat. And as the legend goes, wherever Rama's name is narrated, Hanuman would appear and listen to it.
Mm.
And it seems even as Tulsidas was penning the whole Ramayana, Hanuman was always with him and listening to the whole story.
Okay.
And at this moment when Tulsidas was describing this scene of Ashokana, Hanuman appears and says, "No, you're wrong. You got it wrong there." So Tulsidas says, "What have I written wrong?" He says, "There were no white flowers. There were only red flowers there." And Tulsidas, who was actually seeing the scene in front of his eyes and he was writing it down, he said, "No, there were white flowers." So then there was this argument where Hanuman says, "No, there were red flowers." And then finally Tulsidas says that, "Oh Hanuman, when you went to Ashokana, when you went to Lanka, you were so angry that your eyes were red with anger. And actually you saw the white flowers as red."
Okay.
And then Hanuman says, "Yes, that might be true."
Okay.
Because here was Tulsidas, how many centuries later he was writing the Ramayana, and he was actually getting a better picture of the Ramayana than Hanuman, who actually was going through the whole story as a personal witness. And I think Kasturi in many places revealed, you know, that kind of a maturity which was God-given. And maybe nobody who would have been with Swami all these years might not have been able to appreciate and pen down Satyam Shyam Sundaram the way Kasturi had done it.
Exactly, Prem. And we see this happening even to this day in our own lives. Many of the our experiences with Swami, and it may be dream, it may be in a vision, it may be in a far off place where we are not even physically close to Swami, but all those experiences, when we later digest it, mull over it and look back at it now as a witness rather than a participant in that experience, the lessons, the insight that it holds are many more and things that we have otherwise missed when it happened.
And even if you see a parallel in Shirdi Satcharitra, when Hemad Pant wants to write the story of Shirdi Baba, and he goes to, I think, Shama to request on his behalf. And Shirdi Baba says, "Ask him to make notes and I will guide him." And quite similarly, actually, when Swami sees Kasturi and tells him, "You write my autobiography," Swami tells him, "I will guide you, I will tell you whom to meet, I will tell you whom to get the notes from."
Very right. And now getting to the topic as such, I would just like to, you know, narrate a small, it's a famous story. It is said that the great sage Vedavyasa, who has written the Mahabharata, who has written the, you know, the Upanishads, the Vedas, everything, he is the one who has penned it down for history and for all the world to hear, listen, see and enjoy. Anybody would expect him, because he has written down the treatises on the greatest of scriptures, the greatest of philosophies.
The categorization of the four Vedas is
done by him.
Is done by him. It is believed.
He has done, means, unparalleled work in the scriptures. And so one would expect him to have a great fulfillment and a feeling of satisfaction having done that. But story goes that even after having done the whole thing, Vedavyasa was very dissatisfied. He was not at all happy and he didn't seem to be emanating the bliss that such people were expected to emanate, you know, because of what
such
they have
achievement.
Done. Because of the achievement. So he goes to the celestial sage Narada and he tells him his problem. He says, "You know, I don't know, I'm not satisfied, I don't feel fulfillment." Narada smiles at him and he says, "Naturally, because though you have described all this, all these, whatever you have done, you have not sung the glory of the Lord directly." So he tells him, "You write Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam, which is nothing but the stories of Lord Krishna. And it is said that it is only after writing the Bhagavatam that Vedavyasa got satisfaction, fulfillment and joy." Well, we may not be Vedavyasas, but it is definitely true that how much ever we discuss different philosophies, different teachings, it doesn't feel complete or fulfilling without actually delving into the sweet and beautiful stories of our Lord. So dear listeners, we decided with prayers in our heart that maybe once in every 2 weeks, once every fortnight, we will dedicate the satsang to the story, the sweet story of our dear Sai, the Satyam Shivam Sundaram.
And really, what can be a better message than that? Because Swami himself declares that my life is my message. There are so many other drawings from that the main message, which is his life, and that is the most essential part of the message, because Swami lived every bit of what he taught us. Be it equanimity, be it compassion, be it empathy, sympathy, I think everything Swami had started displaying in his life much, much before he actually declared himself, much before he revealed his divinity to the whole world.
And even after he revealed his divinity and people, were flocking to him, and for many people, his word became the truth and whatever he said, they followed implicitly. In spite of commanding such power, influence, the way Swami conducted himself is really something worth reliving, enjoying and learning from. Because Swami began by saying, my life is my message. And towards the later part of the avatarhood, Swami used to say, your life should become my message. I feel in order to help us make this transition from Swami's life being his message to our lives being his message, we should get to know his life in as much detail as possible, with as much emotion, with as much color and grandeur that it has. So it helps us to embody those virtues and those qualities and learn how we can practically exhibit the same in our lives too.
And I think as an exercise, even if we keep looking at Swami's life over and over again, even though we know we have read the Satyam Shivam Sundaram, we've heard it from Swami himself, we've heard so many people narrate it. In fact, Venkatraman Sahib had that whole series of Miracles of Pure Love where he narrated the entire childhood of Swami, but still, I think listening to it over and over again, with somewhere, if not consciously, at least subconsciously, it would seep into us these messages which Swami has left us with. And I think it's absolutely relevant today as it would be ever in the future to again and again redwell into this.
Thinking of this, Prem, I must confess that I felt a little bit ashamed, because last week when we decided that we will be doing this, I sat recollecting. I could recollect isolated incidents from Swami's life. But frankly, I must confess, I could not place a timeline, If I have to tell some children the future, the story, some of us have been lucky that we heard his story, history from his own divine lips. But if I have to narrate it, I just felt that I do not know the exact timeline. If I try to construct the timeline, it's all little, jumbled up. I don't know what happened when. When you look into the social networking sites like Facebook and all this, where you have a timeline, we are placing together a timeline of our own lives there. And I was just feeling that much more important, I pay so much attention there onto these social networking sites and all this. When Swami is such an integral part of my life, should I not have a timeline of his life ready with me? I felt I should know when what happened. For example, if somebody asked me, what are the important incidents that happened when Swami was a 6-year-old? I don't know. I know only some incident that happened before Swami turned 10, then some incident that happened when he turned 14. But the timeline, I feel if the way I know Ramayana, the story of Lord Rama, that is the way I must know the story of my Sai Rama. And I also recollected, a dream that I had sometime back.
Okay.
In the dream, Swami was moving around in a car and he stopped the car, lowered the window glass, called me to him and asked me whether I believed that he and Shirdi Baba were the same. Mm-hmm. I said, yes, Swami, you are the same. There's no doubt in that. And Swami then asked, what is Shirdi Baba's life story called? I said, Swami, it's Sai Satcharitra.
Okay.
Then Swami said, then what about mine? Can you believe it? In the dream, I was just blanked out. I told Swami, I'm sure there is something written on you. I know that it is there. I'm just not recollecting it. Swami said, think about it. He raised back the glass and drove on. When I woke up the next morning also, I was not clear about it. It was only when I told my mother, then she said, hey, Satyam Shivam Sundaram. I said, oh yeah, Satyam, how could I forget it? Satyam Shivam Sundaram, yes, it is so important, how could I forget it? But last week when we discussed this also, I felt the same. I said, oh my God, I don't think I know the whole Satyam Shivam Sundaram thoroughly. And reading it, dear listeners, let me assure you, reading the Satyam Shivam Sundaram has been such a pleasure, such an uplifting experience. And that is why we felt that it would be of immense benefit to us to read it, and we hope that this same benefit is enjoyed by all our listeners around the world.
And what better way of thinking of Swami than this, than reliving Satyam Shivam Sundaram. Satyam, that's what Swami was called. And it is definitely Shivam, it's all auspiciousness, and Sundaram, no doubt, it is beauty. It is soaked in beauty and soaked in all bliss and joy.
You know, Swami used to say, Satyam, Satyam, the truth, the eternal truth, the only truth is there is, easiness, being, being. And Swami used to say, Shivam or auspiciousness is denoted by awareness. And Sundaram, beauty, that is bliss. So Swami used to say, a person who is being, awareness, bliss, always. B-A-B-A, that is Baba. So he used to say, you know, Swami is Satyam, Shivam, Sundaram. What a beautiful name to give for his biography. And dear listeners, this is what we will be doing once every fortnight, reliving his story and all the beautiful nuances, the subtle messages, the direct messages, everything that Swami taught us. And before we dive into the story proper, I think, Prem, we should play that beautiful Telugu song which describes the glory of Satyam Shivam Sundaram.
I think that particular song, maybe a little later in the program we will play that. But before that, Arvind, maybe we should start with the descriptions which of Puttaparthi, which Kasturi sir starts off the Satyam Shivam Sundaram, the history of Puttaparthi.
Oh, yes. Puttaparthi is a relatively new name as such. I mean, though I remember it as Puttaparthi ever since I have come to Puttaparthi. Even for decades before that, it was Puttaparthi. But story goes that the original name of this village was Gollapalli.
Right.
And it refers to, Gollapalli refers to the cows, the village that was abundant with cows. And they say that this place, Gollapalli, was as beautiful as Krishna's Vrindavan, with lot of cows and cowherds. It was during this time that one of the cowherds, he noticed that his favorite cow, which used to yield a lot of milk, apparently had gone dry. There was no milk coming from its udders, and he was surprised. So one day he decided to follow this cow. He followed this cow. He saw that at one particular time of the day, which was a few hours before the milking, this cow would leave its calf with the other sisters, you know, other cows, and just walk out. So he was amazed. He was wondered, where is this cow walking out? He followed the cow. The cow walked up to an anthill. An anthill which had been occupied by a cobra. And he saw that a cobra would emerge from that anthill and suckle at the udder of the cow and drink all the milk, empty the udders, and then the cow would walk back home. And that was the reason why it would not have any more milk to yield.
Right.
The cowherd grew so angry on the snake for depriving him of the milk from his favorite cow. So he took a huge rock that was nearby, a round rock, and threw it at the snake and killed it on the spot. Legend goes that the snake uttered a curse, because of which the whole of Gollapalli was not transformed, shall I say. It fell down. You know, transform is usually positive. But it got changed into a place, arid place, filled with anthills.
Right. The cobra is said to have cast a curse on the village, saying
correct.
That.
And it cursed that cows will no longer prosper in this town. And therefore the whole region became arid. The cows naturally
slowly started dying.
Dying out, and the numbers reduced. And an anthill is called as Putta. It is also called as Valmiki in Sanskrit.
Right.
Because
Valmika.
Valmika, correct.
Valmika.
Because the great sage Valmiki, when he was actually Ratnakar.
Right.
Ratnakara. Ratnakar was a, you know, bandit. He used to loot people. And when he underwent a change of heart, he began to meditate, and an anthill formed around him. He became the sage Valmiki, named after the Valmikam that developed around him.
The anthill.
And so therefore, from Gollapalli, the village came to be known as Valmikipura.
Right.
Valmikipura is the town of ant hills.
In the local lexicon, it was called Puttaparthi, because Putta refers to as ant hill, as you said. In Sanskrit, it's called Valmika, and in Telugu, it is that the Putta. So what happened is, as you narrated, you know, the whole town gets transformed into this village of ant hills, and the cow population comes down. And that particular stone, which was thrown to kill this cobra, as a kind of repentance, it was enshrined in a temple, and they started worshipping it, the local villages. And in fact, dear listeners, you would be interested to know that that temple still stands.
Yes.
Gopalaswami temple, which you see in Puttaparthi. And I think any of the devotees of Swami who visit Puttaparthi should make it a point to visit these, not just historical sites, because these are legends. I mean, if you go to Mecca, there is that,
Kaaba.
You know, the Kaaba, the place where the Prophet worshipped, the place where he meditated. Then you go to, if you follow the life of Buddha, there is that tree under which he sat and got enlightenment. These are sites of such historical proportions.
And you know, actually this temple, this Gopalaswami temple, is quite empty throughout the day. Right. There's a barber shop opposite to it. The barber shop gets 10 times more people than the temple actually. I had been recently...
I think the problem is also because there is Puttaparthi here.
Correct.
You know, which might draw more crowd than...
No, I'm talking of it as a wonderful thing, because when I went there was nobody.
Right.
I just sat in the temple all by myself.
Definitely, that's definitely a thing there, because...
Very tranquil.
I still know many of my classmates who find... the Gopalaswami temple is a good place to sit and contemplate on Swami, because it's so empty, and it definitely has beautiful vibrations there.
In fact, the priest, he was sitting by the side, he was so happy that I came. He opened the main sanctorum for me, and I could... Now there's a statue of Lord Krishna that has been made, a beautiful statue, and has been kept. But
earlier that stone with only
it is still there.
That stain mark,
yes,
that was
behind.
The only thing which was being
In
worshipped.
Fact, later on, you know, Swami, he showed... On the stone, there were markings which showed Lord Krishna.
Actually, Swami had directed some of the village elders to wash that stone with haldi water.
Hmm.
And when they did that, they found that a very, very distinct image of Krishna playing the flute.
Correct.
And that was, you know, again reinstalled there and worshipped. In fact, for so many years, many of the very pious people in Puttaparthi could hear the sound of flute.
From the stone, that is what legend goes. So dear listeners, when you happen to visit Puttaparthi, do drop into the Gopalaswami temple and make a request to the priest. The priest will be more than willing to oblige, to allow you into the sanctum. And behind the Krishna idol, you will be able to see this stone. It's about between 1/2 foot to 1 foot in diameter. It's about 3/4 of a foot in diameter, a round stone. But it carries such a wonderful history and legend behind it, and as we shall see, in part it was responsible for the Lord taking avatarhood in this holy hamlet of Puttaparthi.
And that's a beautiful way to launch this Satyam Shivam Sundaram discussion. And before we move to the other aspects of Puttaparthi and how Puttaparthi was beginning and preparing itself for a grand blessing, I've got the song which you asked for, Arvind.
Thanks for him. Yeah.
Satyam Shivam Sundaram. A beautiful song, and dear listeners,
been sung by,
before I play it for you, let me tell you that this has been sung by a legend, Shri Ghantasala, and he's very, very popular in the southern part of India, especially in Andhra Pradesh. And he also was a devotee of Swami who has beautiful experiences, who came to Swami towards the later part of his life.
The song is in Telugu, and it has been recorded more than 5 decades back, so technically it may not sound as perfect as a modern recording, but the feeling that it embodies and the message it conveys, both are very profound. The song, now.
Satyam Sivam Sundaram సత్య సాయి బాబావతారం నిశ్చలం నిర్మలం నిత్యమంగళం భక్త కోటినుద్ధరించు రక్తి ముక్తిదాయకం సత్యం శివం సుందరం సత్య సాయి బాబావతారం
ఆ
స్వరూపం రామావతారం లీలా మానుష తేజం కృష్ణావతారం రామకృష్ణ తత్వాలను రంగరించి రూపించిన కలికాలకు ప్రజల గోతు కవిత లలిత ఆధారం సత్యం శివం సుందరం సత్య సాయి బాబా అవతారం మందహాస చంద్రికలను చిందించే వదనం అందరి కష్టాలు బాపి ఆదరించు హృదయం అజ్ఞానుల భావాలకు అందరాని తత్వం తెలుగు సీమలో వెలసిన దివ్యమైన అవతారం దివ్యమైన అవతారం సత్యం శివం సుందరం సత్య సాయి బాబా అవతారం సత్య సాయి బాబా అవతారం.
So after that, a nostalgic song, it leaves such a, you know, yesteryear's flavor when you listen to that. Coming to Puttaparthi, you spoke about Puttaparthi and spoke about Gopalswami temple. Beside it, there is another shrine, the Satyamma temple. But before we come to that, we need to introduce...
Satyamma is the local way of calling Satyabhama, the consort of Lord Krishna.
And in India, there is this tradition that almost every village has its village deity.
Correct.
You know, there is one particular form of divinity which is worshipped by the village, and it is believed that that deity is the protector of the whole village. And so even now, if you see, the major festivals in Puttaparthi, the local festivals, happen in front of the Satyamma temple.
Correct.
Satyamma is considered as the local deity, as
the goddess for Puttaparthi
village. As guardian deity of Puttaparthi village. So coming to how Satyamma temple...
Because that's very special, because Prema, usually we never see a temple where Satyabhama is alone.
Right.
You know, it's always as a consort of Lord Krishna. She's always present, but why this happened, for that we will have to go into the life of one great person, one glorious spiritual person. And dear listeners, you know, as we live this story, this story, you know, would be perfect and ideal. I feel that these are the stories that every mother or every father must tell his or her child before putting them to bed. Instead of stories of imaginary fictional monsters or, you know, all the cartoons that go on, they are fun in a way. But I feel these stories are not only amazing stories, but unconsciously they also build in values and morality in the children. And that's why I'm inspired, and I feel whenever the time comes in the future, these are the stories that I'm going to tell my children. Well, so we go to the personality that Kondamma Raju was. Kondamma Raju, the grandfather of Bhagwan Shri Sathya Sai Baba, he was a very pious and holy person, a person who was loved by everyone in this village, which was Gollapalli, which had become Puttaparthi. And he was helpful to everyone.
He was almost like the doyen of the Raju family.
Correct.
To which Swami was born. And actually the Raju family was popular for its, you know, pious nature, starting from the life of Venkavaduta. Avaduta, as you know, there are avadutas in the Indian tradition where people who have given up all the comfort of home and shelter and family and go out in search of the absolute. And he was one such sage. And he was believed to have lived for so many years. In fact, he was...
Beyond 100.
And he was in this family of the Raju clan. And after him, Kondamma Raju was revered as a very, very pious and wise old man.
He too lived to a ripe old age, beyond 100.
And imposing personality. Swami used to describe him as 6 feet tall. And, you know, and even at that age, even till he was... well into the late 90s, he always used to stand straight, and there is a picture of him sitting upright and Swami standing by him, a very beautiful picture. And he was the person who was instrumental in bringing the Satyamma temple into existence.
Yes, what happened was, one night he had a very strange dream. In the dream, it was raining very heavily and he saw Goddess Satyabhama, the consort of Lord Krishna, standing all alone, forlorn, and getting wet in the rain. And she was asking Kondamaraju to do something about it.
Actually, the story is, there is a mythological story where Satyabhama requests for the Parijata flower from the heavens.
Correct.
So Krishna travels to the heavens
to get the loka,
to get a Parijata flower for Satyabhama.
I think he goes to get the Parijata tree itself.
The tree itself. Actually, he gives the Parijata flower, I think, to Rukmini, his
other consort.
The other consort. And in a move to pacify Satyabhama, he says, I'll get you the tree from the heavens. And the scene which Kondamaraju sees is that Satyabhama is waiting under the tree and it is raining and she's waiting for Krishna to come back from heaven. That is the scene he sees in the dream, and Kondamaraju runs to her and says, Mother, why do you stand and get soaked in the rain? And she says, I have no place to stay. You know, and that is when he wakes up and he says,
I'm going to build a temple for her.
I want to build a temple for her, a gudi, like how it is locally called here. And that is how he, you know, gathers the elders in the village and proposes the idea of building a Satyabhama temple.
And actually the Satyabhama temple too, the Satyabhama gudi, is just about a few meters away from the Gopalaswami temple.
Right.
And yes, the visitor who is visiting the Gopalaswami temple must also visit the Satyabhama temple. Before that, Prem, I don't know, I just felt like narrating this. The story that we talked about, the Parijata flower, Parijata tree story.
Right.
That also has a very, you know, beautiful message. As you rightly said, you know, Satyabhama got jealous that Rukmini got this flower from Krishna and Krishna loves her more than he loves me. It is so often we see this, you know, we used to be sitting in darshan lines and Swami is walking around and we think that, you know, Swami is showering attention on that person. Instead of feeling happy for the person, we feel jealous. We feel that, why is this not happening to me? What is this? What is so special about that person that it's not? This kind of jealousy, Swami has said in his discourse, that it has no cure. Whatever happens, it will not get cured, and that jealousy itself will bring ruin upon you. The story of the Parijata tree goes that Satyabhama, because she saw this, she felt that if she gets a Parijata flower, I want the whole tree itself. So she requests Krishna, and the story of how Lord Krishna goes and gets the Parijata tree in itself is an amazing story. Mm-hmm. But keeping that aside, what happens is Krishna gets it and he tells, I've got the tree, what do you want me to do? And Satyabhama says, you plant it in my yard. So he planted in his yard and Satyabhama thinks, now let look Rukmini see. When she sees, she'll see that, you know, I have got the tree in my yard, and she'll understand that she got only the flower, I got the tree. But then it so happens that every day when the breeze blows, the flowers fall into the yard of Rukmini. So though the tree is in Satyabhama's yard, the flowers still go to Rukmini. So, you know, there are many such stories between Satyabhama and Rukmini. And it almost seems like a divine play that was enacted to inspire the devotee that whenever something good happens, celebrate the good. Because as we discussed in the previous satsang, whenever we see good in others, that good comes to us also. Whenever we start feeling bad about others and see bad in others, that bad comes to us also.
And it's a very important point that you mentioned, Arvind, that saying that there is no cure for jealousy. Because we think the cure for jealousy is getting more than the other person whom you're jealous of.
Correct.
But Swami has also reiterated so many times that it doesn't happen. So, and as we had discussed last time, gratitude, you know, gives you more opportunities to be grateful. Maybe being jealous will
give you more opportunities to feel jealous. I don't think I can call it an opportunity. It will put you into that terrible situation where you will have to feel jealous more and more. So let's not get into that jealous cycle. Let's always celebrate the good that happens to others. In fact, it reminds me of another episode, you know. Never had I got vibhuti directly from Swami's hands. You know, Swami would wave his hand. That motion is so familiar when we see, you know, in middle of the darshan line, he stands, takes a step back, starts waving his right hand in a circle, creates vibhuti and he gives.
Right.
I had got many opportunities to offer him a white handkerchief to wipe his hands after he creates vibhuti. But never had I received vibhuti from his hands.
Okay.
I remember on one occasion when I was so sick, I requested him for vibhuti, he never gave it to me. But at the same time, another boy, you know, he had a boil on his head and it looked like a pretty simple pimple, just a matter of time before it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And Swami expressed so much concern for him and created vibhuti and gave it to him. I felt this is terrible injustice, you know. I'm having far greater medical problems and here is Swami giving vibhuti for some small pimple. And this is what used to happen. That was a time when during one of the Parayanam sessions, you know, that is why the Parayanam sessions are where the teachers speak Swami stories and describe Swami's experiences. You know, we were saying that this should be done to the children because they form impressions, make us form impressions in such a strong manner. I remember listening in that Parayanam when the teacher said that when you feel jealous like this, you will be deprived of what you are seeking, because that jealousy is such a disease and it has no cure. And to my utter shock, if I can say so, he used exactly the same example that I was going through. He said, for example, if Swami comes and creates vibhuti to a person next to you, you look and you start feeling jealous and think, why I'm not getting it? What is so special in that other person? I said, my God, is he talking to me? And then he said, instead of feeling jealous about that, if you can feel that, you know, him getting vibhuti is equivalent to me getting vibhuti, because he's my brother after all. If you can rejoice and celebrate for him, I can promise you that there is a greater chance of you getting vibhuti than if you feel jealous. And he said it with such vehemence and confidence that I decided to test it out. And from that day onwards, I would keep doing it. Telling every time when somebody gives vibhuti, I'll feel happy. I tell, yes Swami, I'm so happy he got vibhuti. But I must confess that I was doing it because I was hoping that by doing this sometime I'll get vibhuti. It took a lot of time. Finally what happened is I gave up expecting vibhuti, but I used to do it because that became my habit now. If somebody gets vibhuti, I'll feel happy. And another reason I used to feel happy is because I now can rush to Swami and give him a handkerchief and get a chance to go close to Swami while I'm giving him a handkerchief. One occasion Swami materialized vibhuti in this manner and I ran with the handkerchief, and as Swami gave him, he looked at me, I just offered the handkerchief, zero expectation. But then Swami smiled, he told me, show your hand, and then he gave vibhuti in my hand. And at that time it hit me and I felt, oh my God, if I really rejoice when others are getting good, I attract that same good onto myself unconsciously. And if I feel sad, depressed, and if I feel negative when some good is happening to others, unconsciously I am pushing that good further and further away from myself because I am responding negatively to the good. So, more or less it is deeply ingrained in me that whenever good happens to somebody, we must rejoice.
And also, you know, that is also a sign of a spiritual person, in a sense, when I say that, you know, this feeling is spontaneous. And suppose you are not getting something which somebody else is getting, especially when it's something as special as something from Swami.
Hmm.
I think the feeling is spontaneous, that you feel hurt or you feel missed. But I think the challenge is that, you know, the jealousy is when you ask, why him?
Hmm.
But the question that has to be asked is, why not me? What should I do to be in that position? And that is what a spiritual person always looks inside. He doesn't ask like, why should he get it?
Correct.
You know, how does he deserve it? But you know, how can I deserve it? What should I do to deserve it?
Beautiful point, Prem. Look inside and try to, yes.
Because that feeling of hurt is so spontaneous, maybe it will take effort to spontaneously not have that feeling when such a thing happens. Maybe to, channelize that energy in a way it would benefit you individually in your progress to Swami. Maybe to ask, why not me?
Hmm.
So it's a, I hope it's a useful digression that we've had. And coming back to the story which we've been narrating.
Correct. So this Kondama Raju, he was also a great playwright. He was an actor. It is said that he often donned the role of Lakshmana, the brother of Lord Rama, and he knew the entire Ramayana by heart.
Especially that one particular version of Ramayana, the Lepakshi
version
of Ramayana.
Dear listeners, without appearing like as if we are trying to promote the places around Puttaparthi, I must say that Lepakshi Prem, have you been there to Lepakshi?
No, I have not had the opportunity to be there.
Oh, then let me market it even to you. You know, I have been there at least 10 times.
Right.
Lepakshi is about an hour's drive from Puttaparthi.
Right.
It comes near
one of the historical
Bagepalli,
sites, right?
Yes. And there's a beautiful temple there. It's actually a fort temple. It is said to be of the Vijayanagar Kingdom times.
Dedicated to Lord Shiva. Right?
Yes.
If I'm not wrong.
Yes, Lord Shiva. In the Bhairava form, you know, it's...
Okay.
And it is actually Lord Veerabhadra. That is the form. The
okay.
Veerabhadra. But the beauty of the Lepakshi temple, Prem, is that right next to the Lord Veerabhadra temple there,
mm-hmm.
inside this main temple, there are four sections.
Okay.
And right next to Lord Veerabhadra is Lord Vishnu.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very rare... where you find both Lord Vishnu and Shiva in the same temple.
Mm-hmm.
That is the uniqueness inside the temple. But coming outside, the stone architecture is
very famous for that.
Famous. I mean, it's simply mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, I've gone there 10 times to do photography.
Mm-hmm.
There is also a huge footprint in the rock there. It measures about, 3 feet maybe.
Okay.
2.5 to 3 feet, the footprint is. And legend goes that it is the footprint of Mother Sita.
Hmm.
It goes that way. And surprisingly, this, I have seen it with my own eyes. From the big toe of the footprint, there is a magical water that keeps coming
right.
and filling up the footprint.
Mm-hmm.
You, even in the peak of summer, when everywhere else it is dry, you remove that entire water, the footprint again fills up with water within minutes.
Right.
And you know how the place got its name? Lepakshi?
Oh, you should tell me that.
They say that this was the place where Ravana, when he was kidnapping Sita, he was flying, the forest, Dandakaranya is, forest is supposed to be located somewhere in Maharashtra, Madhya Pradesh in India.
Okay.
Down south is Andhra, and definitely Ravana would have passed over this region while going to Lanka.
Right.
Sri Lanka, the modern day Sri Lanka. He says this was the place where the bird Jatayu attacked
okay.
Ravana.
Inclined
and Ravana severed the wings of the bird and it died. It fell down at this spot. That is where they say Lord Rama came and said, Le Pakshi.
Okay.
Le meaning in Telugu, get up.
Get up.
Get up, O bird. And you know that bird Jatayu had the great privilege of getting its final rites done at the hands, divine hands of Lord Rama. A privilege that even...
Dasharatha did not have.
Exactly. Rama's father.
Rama left.
So... in honor of that, this temple has been built. And there are many stories connected to the Ramayana and Jatayu which are there.
Okay.
And when you see the footprint, you'll imagine that, my God, Sita must have been a really tall person.
Mm-hmm.
And Swami describes Sita as a short person who could not put a garland to Rama. So you can just imagine the size of Rama. But then, I think sometime in Kodai, Swami had materialized a
right.
ring of Lord Rama and it was like a bangle, like a bracelet for...
Yeah, and in fact, another time Swami materialized a chain, a necklace kind of thing, which Ravana used to wear.
Huh.
And I remember that description of how it was materialized. You know, a huge, maybe, the size of the biggest cell phone you have now.
Okay.
That size, a medallion it had.
My
it was
God.
Almost like a mandapam, three lingams encased in a mandapam of that size.
Like a little shrine it was.
A little shrine.
And that's the pendant.
Okay, that's the pendant. And the chain was made of 105 lingams.
Oh.
A string of 105 lingams. Adding to the three which was already in the...
making a total of 108.
And Swami said this was what Ravana wore. And just for a fraction of a moment, Swami wore it on himself.
Uh-huh.
And it came to almost Swami's,
knee.
Little above Swami's knee.
Oh.
And Swami took it out and Swami said... it happened to be necktied for Ravana.
So you can only imagine
the size of the
and
characters.
Swami has said on many occasions that, in the Treta Yuga, in the Dwapara Yuga, they were very, very tall and they even lived long.
Right.
I don't know the exact number, but I feel Swami, I remember Swami saying that Arjuna was somewhere beyond 100 years when he
right.
actually fought the Mahabharata war.
Arjuna was 86 or something.
And
Krishna was 85, 86. And Arjuna was 70.
Oh, something.
And Bhishma was way beyond 120, 130, like that. And Swami used to say that in the period of Ramayana, people used to live even longer. Because it is, according to Ramayana, it is said that Ramaraja alone lasted 100 years. After
okay.
he was coronated. And before Rama decided to bring the avatar to an end, he's supposed to have ruled for 100 years.
And Prem, though people may think that these are just, stories and maybe myths, even scientifically, this thing has been shown.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the larger the mammal, the longer it lives.
Okay.
Among all the mammals, you except man. Man has got artificial ways of boosting his life. and artificial ways of ending it also within 5-6 years. Among all the land animals, the longest living mammal that you see is the elephant.
Right.
So, and the shortest living ones are usually the rats, the small ones. They live a few years and they die out. So, it is seen that there is some kind of relation, a very strong correlation between body size and life expectancy.
Right.
So, when Swami says that in the bygone era, people were very tall and they lived very long lifetimes, it is not that it is totally unscientific or something like that.
Right.
Science is often the lesser circle of spirituality. So, even science has discovered that. Well, I think that is
it. So, that's Lepakshi, and Lepakshi took us to Ramayana, and Ramayana took us to...
Oh, okay. So, yeah, the Lepakshi version of Ramayana was what Kondama Raju knew.
Right. And actually, he was very, very popular as a playwright, as an actor, because he, as you said, you know, he was playing the role of Lakshmana, and also because of his very pious nature. And it is believed that once Venkavaduta comes, and he used to very often visit Kondama Raju, because he was an avaduta, is a person who roams from place to place.
Mm.
So every time he used to come near the southern part, near Puttaparthi, he would come and visit Kondama Raju. And it seems that one particular occasion when he came and met, he was in tears, he was in bliss.
Okay.
And Kondama Raju was asking, what is causing you to be in such raptures? And, you know, the Venkavaduta says that, you know, you are blessed.
Mm.
Our whole lineage is blessed.
Mm.
The Lord is going to come down. And the Lord has chosen our clan. And you know, Kondama Raju could not really comprehend the news which he was hearing.
Correct.
And he was saying, in our clan, in our life, you know, are we going to be able to see that Lord in our lifetime? He was so happy to hear that news.
He felt that his Rama that he has been worshipping for so long will now be part of his clan, his lineage. It was such a proud moment. While that happened on that front, on the worldly front, what happened was, one of Kondama Raju's, I don't remember whether brother or sister, cousin, he stayed in a place called Kolimi Gundla, which is about 100 kilometers from Puttaparthi. But in between Puttaparthi and Kolimi Gundla, there are some forests. Now they have depleted, of course, as they have happened worldwide. But those times, that is more than nearly 100 years ago, they were very thick forests and
infested with
the wilder among the animals, that is the human animals, manimals.
Humans. And you know, Kasturi sir narrates how the Raju family had some fields in that particular part of those villages, and in the name of showing those property to his eldest son, that was Pedda Venkama Raju, he had two sons. And there's a bit of confusion in the name actually, you know, because locally he is referred to as Pedda Venkamma Raju and Chinna Venkamma Raju.
But in many literature we see it as Venkappa Raju and Chinna Venkappa Raju.
Right, even in different literature, Swami used to refer to him as Venkamma Raju. And
so dear listeners, Venkamma Raju, Venkappa Raju are the same people.
So he actually thought that he will take his son to this particular area and show that these are our property. So it will be a way of passing on, you know, the property information to the generations to come.
But he had a hidden agenda.
Right.
His idea was, those who had settled there, if they can be brought back to Puttaparthi, they would be safe. He wouldn't have worries about them.
Right.
One good way of getting them back to Puttaparthi was to offer the hand of his eldest son, that is Pedda Venkama Raju, to the daughter there.
Right.
That great lady is whom we know today as Srimati Ishwaramma.
Right.
And that was how the alliance was fixed, the marriage was performed, and they say that Ishwaramma's family shifted to currently what is known as Karnata Nagepalli.
Just across Chitravati River.
Just across the Chitravati River.
And quite often visit it, in fact, every Gram Seva we get to go there.
Correct. And it's on the eastern banks of Chitravati.
You just take that bridge in over Chitravati, which you see now. It just takes about 5 minutes to walk across and reach Karnata Nagepalli.
Hmm.
Right.
So Karnata Nagepalli, that's how they settled there. Now, the other details, I think we'll just fast forward a little bit and come to that beautiful day when, you know, that is the climax that happened. But I think before we go into the description of all the things that happened, I think we'll just play that song. That song that immortalizes Ishwaramma for the greatest, greatest ever boon that she conferred on all of us. Even today, when we feel that the reason of our life is Swami, we owe a part of that gratitude to Mother Ishwaramma for having given us this beautiful Sai.
Danya ho Ishwaramma, jag ko di jo Lal Baba. Danya ho, danya ho, कलयुग में अवतार लिए सकल चराचर के भगवान जगदोद्धारा साई नारायण धन्य हो धन्य हो धन्य हो जग को दीजो लाल बाबा
Wow, wasn't that beautiful, Prem? It makes you get so lost in the melody, and really whoever has sung that has also sung it with so much of gratitude. Yes, it arouses gratitude in our heart also to that great lady. In fact, her original name was Namagiri Amma.
Right.
But because, as you said, you know, Venkavaduta has already told Kondamaraju that the Lord will be taking birth in your clan, and well, we will come to the description of the actual birth later on. Kondamaraju recognized this and therefore said that you, from today onwards, you are not Namagiri Amma. You are the mother of Ishwara. You are the mother of the Lord. And therefore you are Ishwaramma. It is from that day, it is actually after the birth of Ishwara, our Sai Ishwara, that Namagiri Amma became Ishwaramma.
It is not believed that tradition still is there in some of the Indian families where the name of the bride is changed after marriage.
Correct.
And that is how Kondamaraju chose this name Ishwaramma for her, and quite providentially he has done that.
Very apt, very perfect. That's why, you know, Prem, when I see all these happening now, I'm convinced that nothing is by chance, nothing is by accident. Everything has been so well planned. And just that realization gives me so much of joy and comfort, because many times we fall into depression or frustration or sorrow because we think that, you know, things are going out of control, things are going out of hand, things are happening by accident. The truth that nothing is by chance, nothing is by accident, everything is part of His master plan, a plan that has been chalked out by our Swami, who is so powerful and so loving. That should give us a lot of solace. It should give us a kind of feeling that, you know, God has a plan. That's all we need to know. Let's not worry about anything.
Really, and you know, even this particular episode is not mentioned in Satyam Shivam Sundaram. Mm-hmm. Swami revealed it much later.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at one particular point, one devotee asks Swami that, Swami, is yours Prasava or Pravesha?
Prasava or Pravesha.
Where Prasava means a normal delivery.
Conception. Conceptual delivery.
Right. And pravesha is when the soul decides to enter the womb and use the womb as a channel to enter the earth.
And so genetics do not matter there.
Right. And it was then when Swami called Isharamma and told her, you tell what happened on that particular day. And then she narrates that, you know, these village ladies have this habit of having to walk up to the village well, fetch water in pots, and each household, you know, collects water from a common well. So one day when she was drawing water from that well, she just found a luminescent ball in the sky.
A blue ball.
Yeah, which caught her attention. And even as she was seeing it, she found that, you know, it was fast approaching towards her. It came and it merged in her and she lost consciousness.
It entered her womb.
Entered
That's
her
what
womb.
She said.
And then when she woke up, I think a few days later, she got the news that she was carrying.
So, the Swami, difference between prasava and pravesha is that one is apparently fate or destiny. The other is like a choice. All of us do not have that choice, you know. It's only an avatar that has the choice of choosing the parents. And that is what happened, whether it was Rama. Rama too was not born from prasava. It is said that the payasam, the pudding that was drunk by Mother Kausalya, she gave birth to Rama. Krishna, in the prison, both his parents were separately chained. There was no way they could even come to each other. And Lord Krishna was born. So, all divine births have happened because of choice, by choice. And that was how even our dear Swami took birth.
And in fact, even if you look at the life of Jesus Christ, and interestingly, tomorrow is Good Friday.
Oh, indeed, a very good Friday.
And in fact, Jesus also is said to be born of Immaculate Conception. Mother Mary is the Virgin Mother, as she's referred to as. And coming back to the story,
it is said that, you know, the day Swami, you know, this as we described, you know, Kondamaraju was a great playwright. He was a good dramatist. Because of which, there used to be some musical instruments at home. He used to have the tanpura, which he used to use for singing. There used to be a dhol, a drum for percussion,
right,
a harmonium and some cymbals. This was family property, which would be given out to the different people for conducting these village plays and all this. You know, they used to observe that at night, the tanpura would start twanging by itself.
Right.
The instruments would start playing by themselves. And when they tried to investigate into the matter, they found no possible reason why it could happen. They shut the doors, the windows, so that, you know, the wind doesn't do this. But it was not depending on the wind. The musical instrument seemed to be played by some unseen hand. And that unseen hand seemed very skilled and talented too.
Right. In fact, the story goes that Bhagwan's father, he goes to a soothsayer, I think in Bukkapatnam.
Correct.
And asks him,
Shastri in Bukkapatnam.
Right. And narrates the whole incident of how instruments are playing on their own. And he asks them, what does this sign show? And he was so surprised, and he, you know, refers to all his texts and he says it's a very, very auspicious sign. It's a sign of something absolutely phenomenal going to happen to your
something
family.
Something of untold magnitude,
right,
and...
But it's all auspiciousness. That's what he said. It's untold auspiciousness or unimaginable auspiciousness which is going to happen. And, you know, Swami used to narrate this earlier also, that during the last few months of that pregnancy, Isharamma is doing the Satyanayana Vratam, which is very common in South India, and even in North it's very common, where the Lord is worshipped in the form of Satyanarayana.
And you know, this is something that every married couple do immediately after marriage.
Right.
It is said to confer upon the couple very good children, especially the lady. She engages in this puja. The husband is also part, but at times it can be done without the husband, but not without the wife. The Satyanarayana puja is always done as a custom, as a tradition.
And it was the practice of Isharamma's mother-in-law, that is Kondamaraju's wife, Lakshmanamma. She was also performing the Satyanarayana Vratam for, you know, the safe delivery of the child which Isharamma was carrying. And the story goes that, you know, when actually Isharamma is in labor pains, she's at the Satyanarayana temple offering worship.
No, she's at somebody's home.
Somebody's house, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
And offering worship there. And that eventful day, the 23rd of November, and she was called saying that Ishwarama has
had a village woman runs to the mother-in-law, Ishwarama's mother-in-law, and tells her that, you know, your daughter-in-law is about to deliver, you are urgently needed there. And she says, no way am I going to interrupt the worship here, because what is going to happen, even, you know, just like Kondamma Raju, even she knew what was that something, the birth that is happening is something very special. And so she told that the birth will not happen, I will, till I come there with the prasadam. I shall come there with the prasadam. And she, it indeed happened that way. Once she left the, once the puja was complete,
worship
was complete, she goes to Ishwarama and hands over the prasadam. And Ishwarama partakes the prasadam, after which the delivery happens.
And a perfect day, it's a beautiful Monday, meant for worship of Shiva.
The Kartika Somavaram.
It's a very special month, Kartika itself. Mm. And in that Somavaram, even now actually, the Kartika Somavaram is a very, very special festival in, you know, temples. Where
especially
Shiva
temples.
Shiva
yes.
is worshipped.
So that's why he's called Somashekara.
Right. Because the Monday is very, very special
for Lord Shiva.
And so it was a beautiful Monday morning and Brahma Murtam. It was, I think, five-ish around that time. And the year, you know, every year has a particular name, right?
The Hindu cycle follows a cycle of 60 years which repeat after each other.
And each one,
for example, this year is, I think, Nandana, right?
Right, I think so.
Yeah. So, in that manner, the year in which Bhagwan Baba was born in 1926, that was the Akshaya.
Akshaya.
Meaning the infinite.
Infinite.
A never diminishing, ever increasing. That is the Akshaya, that is the year in which Baba was born. And yeah, Prem, I think this is the right time to sort out one small, you know, a doubt or an issue that often arises. It is said that, you know, Swami was born on Kartika Somavaram. But if we check the English calendar, the 23rd of November happens to be a Tuesday. It happens to be a Tuesday in 1926. So, how does this...
Yeah, actually, you know, in the English style of determining the days and the months, you know, you see the next day begins at 12 in the midnight.
Yeah.
That's how we celebrate the New Year's Day also, right? No?
At midnight.
At 12 we start the celebrations. But according to the Indian tradition of, you know, setting the times for a day, it is believed that the day starts with daybreak.
Okay, so when the sun rises, the new day begins.
So invariably, if you see an Indian calendar, you know, be it whichever language calendar it is, there will also be mentioned the time of daybreak. Because it is believed the day starts then. So invariably, if you see, especially, you know, the November time, that's the winter time, where the daybreak is a little later. So the daybreak is actually at 6:30
or 6:27. Correct.
So till that time, it is still the previous day. That is why it is a Somavaram. Though according to the English calendar, 23rd November 1926 is a Tuesday, according to the Indian tradition, it is actually still the Kartika Somavaram.
That's why many times, you know, even when we calculate this Ashtami, Saptami and all these,
right,
these days also they seem to be beginning from the afternoon, because it is not exactly according, well, I mean, that is also because of the lunar thing that comes in right, those calendars. But as you said, so actually there is no confusion. If you see strictly by the calendar, early hours in the morning of a Tuesday that Swami was born, but in the Indian calendar, till the sunrise, it is still a Somavaram, and therefore, there is no actual, in reality, there is no clash. It is the same thing, but it is a Kartika Somavaram. According to the English calendar, it was early hours of Tuesday morning.
And the other interesting episode which happens when the child is born and delivered, you know, they give that traditional bath to the newborn infant and they place it on a pile of clothes laid on the ground. And the visitors come and they see the child. And when they saw, they found that this baby was actually undulating up and down, as though something was moving under it. So immediately the elders come and pick up the child and remove the sheets of cloth, and they find a huge cobra wriggling under that.
Oh.
Almost like the cobra was being the bed to the Lord.
And that is reminiscent...
Not almost like, it was the case.
That is reminiscent of what, you know, happened. If you see Lord Vishnu in the Kshira Sagara, he lies on the snake. And even when Lord Krishna was being transported, you know, a snake comes and shields.
Right.
And the hood actually was about the baby, but the baby was smiling and the cobra that was there under Swami's bed just slid away and moved off without causing any harm or anything. But that was one of the first few signs to show that the baby born in the house is not ordinary.
Right, and you know, if you see so many signs where Swami was showing that, you know, not extremely mind-boggling signs, but very subtle ones.
The baby never cried for one.
Right, that also is mentioned. And, you know, and the other thing is Swami was not the first child. Swami had two sisters. One elder brother, Seshamaraja Garu, and Parutamma and
Venkamma.
So, you know, Swami was entering a household where there were many children, actually. And in the Satyam Shamsundram, it's also said that the two brothers lived together, Peda Venkama Raju, Chinna Venkama Raju, and also one of the daughters of Kondamma Raju.
Hmm.
So it was a huge family with about 15-20 children. And in such an environment, Swami always stood out, even as an infant, even as a small child.
Correct. For example, he would always insist on having either the vibhuti on his forehead or the kumkum.
Right.
Not or actually, vibhuti and the kumkum. He wanted both, you know. And they say that if at all, they would get wiped out, you know, when you put vibhuti or kumkum. During the course of the day, it gets wiped out sometime. The minute it goes away, he immediately goes and again applies vibhuti and kumkum. And I think so, naturally it is the case because he is, you know, how, that is another story, but he is considered as the Shiva Shakti avatara, the Shiva Shakti, which contains both Shiva and the Shakti. Vibhuti for the Shiva and Kumkum for the Shakti makes absolute sense. And I think about the story of how he is Shiva Shakti and what is the legend about that, I think we shall reserve it for a later time.
Where the declaration part of the story comes. But you know, one interesting thing was, you know, how Kasturi wrote this Satyam Shamsundram, as he expressed to Swami the very first time when he was handpicked for this job. He said, Swami, I don't know anything about you.
Hmm.
And in fact, I don't even approach you in a manner a devotee should. And so when he wrote Satyam Shamsundram, he actually went and met many of these elderly people who were there when Swami was born. You know, his friends who were his playmates, his brothers, Seshamaraju, his sisters. And he recorded all the peculiar patterns of behavior which Swami exhibited all through his childhood. You know, things like he was not interested in material objects at all.
Correct.
Not like the other children. Because children, you know, you find some amount of selfishness in children. You know, that the nature to grab, the nature to...
Nature to grab is secondary. But before that, there's getting attracted.
Right.
Because it's everything is new for them.
Exactly.
It's something new and they get attracted to anything shiny, anything. And because of that attraction, they want to hold more than selfishness maybe. Yeah.
And actually, that is the beauty of childhood. You know, it's not selfishness. If you don't give a child what it wants, it will cry. But the very next moment, it can forget. So it's not wrong in wanting. But as Swami says, the detachable attachments.
Correct.
That is what is missing with us. Coming back to, but even that kind of a behavior was never exhibited by Swami.
Hmm.
Swami would always give to the other. And
he was always, you know, one of the most important differences between him and everybody else was, somehow, he was a strict vegetarian.
Exactly.
He never touched non-vegetarian food, though it was part of their, you know, culture to eat non-meat. That is one thing that endeared him to the grandfather Kondamma Raju, because Kondamma Raju himself was a strict vegetarian.
Right.
He never subscribed to touching meat or... because of different reasons. One is, of course, he didn't want to trouble them. And those things, apparently from birth itself, were inherent in this little Satya. By the way, yes, the baby was named Satyanarayana Raju. And it is very significant because Satyanarayana was the vrata that we discussed, you know, that was done. The story goes that Ishwaramma actually had, as you said, one elder son and two daughters after that. She somehow pined for one more son. They say that she wanted one more son. And that's why she had done a special Satyanarayana Puja. A special Satyanarayana Vrata. And so, since she believed that it was a result of this Satyanarayana Vrata that the baby was born, they named the child Satyanarayana.
And, you know, very endearingly, very beautifully, he used to be called as Satyam.
Satyam.
The family used to refer to him as Satyam
At this point, Prem, I'm going to go into one more digression. I can't help but go into that.
I'm waiting for you to finish because I want to go to another one.
Okay, you pause it and keep it in your mind and I'll go into the digression. See, you know, I was reading that day the King James version of the Bible.
Okay.
And, you know, we were talking about how everything is part of the master plan and what things appear like accident and all, slowly their meaning develops later on.
Right.
In that, when I was reading, there, when they talk of the second coming of Christ, they mention different identifying characteristics. And if you see those characteristics, each of them perfectly matches Swami. One of the first identifying characteristics, you know what it is? They say that his name will be the truth. And what was he named? Satyanarayana, and called Satyam. Satyam, which means truth. And you know, it is different. It is not truth. Satyam, if we see in Sanskrit, is the highest truth. It's not just a fact that, you know, Usain Bolt is the fastest runner in the world. It'll change after 5 years from now. He'll no longer be the fastest. That's a fact. That is Nijam.
Right.
But this is Satyam. Satyam, which means absolute truth. And, you know, it's almost like the scriptures, not almost like, it is the scriptures finding fulfillment. Everything is part of the plan, even the name, the form, everything is part of the master plan. Well, my digression is done. It's up to you now.
No, I just remembered one beautiful incident which happened. One of my classmates, you know, after he got his first child, nowadays in the IT, this one, they have this, like you have maternal leaves, you have paternal leaves also.
Oh, okay.
So he never took it when his wife was actually pregnant because he wanted to take it after the child was born. Those 10 days or 1 week, he could come and sit here and try to get a name from Swami for his child.
Okay.
That was his plan. So after his child was born, he came here and he informed Swami of the thing and he prayed to Swami for a name. And that particular day when Swami had come for darshan, Swami came and heard the whole thing and Swami gave him a name, some Ramakrishna or something like that. And then Swami went off. So this boy was seated and Swami that day completed the round and came back for a second round. And came again to him, called this classmate of mine, and he said, "What name did I tell for your son?" So he said, "Swami, you said something Ramakrishna, whatever." So he said, "Okay, that name is okay. I'll give you another name." So he said, "Keep Satya, my name." You know, very sweetly, Swami said, "Keep Satya, my name. It's a very nice name."
As if like justifying that it's indeed a good name.
No, I was just reminded of that. Very beautiful, because I was, I think, sitting behind him or something when that happened. So beautifully, Swami said, "My name." You know. And so, coming back to Swami's childhood, and you know, that was the feature of Swami's childhood.
He was compassionate spontaneously. You know, anytime any person came begging for alms, he would spontaneously see whatever is there in the house and give it off. You know, it is said that Ishwaramma and his elder sisters at times used to lock the, you know, whatever little granary was there at the home house. Because otherwise, this boy would simply empty out everything, all the grains to anybody, and he seemed to have a heart that melted even in the cold, you know, like that. Very buttery heart.
And you know, in the later part, Kasturi also describes that not only was he giving charity to people who came to the doorstep, it started happening that he would go out into the road and see if anybody was needy, bring them to the house and give them whatever they needed.
Exactly. On one occasion, in fact, Ishwaramma scolds him.
Right.
Tells him that, you know what, if you keep giving like this, you won't have any food to eat. From that day,
In fact, Ishwaramma says that if you give next time, we will give your share.
We will give your share, you won't have.
You will not have.
She thought that would be like a deterrent for him. But no, the next day when without fail, he simply got the beggar home, gave the food, and then he refused to eat also. He said that I've already had my fill. And you know what he said? He said that when he is fulfilled and contented, I automatically feel contented. Even at, you know, when they say that the Lord is there in everybody, you know, the story of Abob and Adam, right, that you may not love God, but you love His creation, you automatically become the most loved for God. That is the thing, because Swami, if we want to make Swami feel fulfillment, if we want to make Swami happy, we have to make everyone happy. When the Lord's creation is happy, the Lord is automatically happy. And this is seen so clearly because little Satya told Mother Ishwaramma that when that man is no longer hungry, I am also not hungry. When he is contented and satisfied, I am also satiated, contented and satisfied.
And the other incident which happens also, right?
Which is that? Oh, yes.
Yeah.
That
what happens is that, you know, when the mother gets very worried that Satya is not eating food.
Yes, she goes and she tries to pamper him. She tries to tell him, eat, eat. But then Satya is so, you know, if I can say, positively stubborn,
right,
that he will not eat because his share has to be given. That finally, you know, the mother relents. She says, okay, whomever you get, we will feed them. We will, but you please eat. It is only then he relents. So in that, in the process, if you see, a 4-year-old has taught his parents such wonderful lessons of being selfless. You know, they were not a very rich family. Every time when I look back at it, I feel, you know, if Swami could have chosen a very rich and influential family, it would have been useful for his mission, right? Because we think of his mission as the number of centers he set up, the number of institutions he has set up, the number of people whom he has gathered. But God doesn't come for that. God doesn't come to set institutions. That's a very foolish and wrong way the world measures. That is how world measures the world. But the Lord comes for a far greater and noble purpose. To build up love for God and human values in people. He doesn't care for the publicity. And he started off at such a young age also. You may think that you have nothing, but you know, there are people who have nothing compared to what you have. So it is your duty to help them. That is what he instilled. And that I feel is again another masterstroke in his master plan of taking birth in a family that was not very well to do or very wealthy.
Imagine somebody who had the power of choice, he could have chosen anything, but he chose this. And it turned out to be a perfect platform for him to, you know, give out his message to the whole world. And you know, the other incident which was narrated in Satyam Shivam Sundaram is when clothes are bought for the children. As I narrated, there were about 15-20 children in that one single household. So the elders used to go out into towns like Bukkapatnam and Kottacheru and bring clothes for the entire family. They used to bring actually material, cloth material, which used to be stitched.
Correct.
So each one had to come and choose what they wanted. But Swami would always stay aside and he would say that, let all the children choose. And then I will pick up my, you know, cloth. So it was like, one thing was selflessness. And the other thing he was teaching was, his happiness did not depend on these things. Because he did not do it, you know, in a high-handish way. Or he just felt that, you know, I'll be happy anyway, no matter what I wear. And you know, another interesting incident which I'm reminded is one of our old students once met with Ishwarama's sister.
Okay.
Okay, and she was a grand old lady then when he met, nearing hundreds. So he would go to her every day and say that, why don't you tell me something about Swami's childhood and all that. And she was well into, you know, last lap of her life, and she memory was failing her. But one thing she narrated, she said, I remember one thing, that one particular day, for some reason, Swami's elder brother, Seshamaraju, scolded him for something. And little Swami started crying, you know, inconsolably. Nobody could silence him. So, you know, even nowadays in villages, they have this thing where a man comes and sells clothes door to door. They have this huge umbrella and they will have the clothes stacked in that umbrella.
Yeah, the umbrella will be held upside down.
And he would come around. So such a man was coming around in Puttaparthi. So they called him and they thought that let's get something for the little boy and pacify him. Okay, so they bring this man who's selling these clothes into the house.
Bribe him into silence.
Okay. And so they tell little Satyam, they just pick up some shirt. So in among all those pile of clothes which was there, Swami put his hand inside and Swami pulled out an ochre shirt.
Okay.
And Swami said, I like this color.
Hmm.
And she said, I distinctly remember that because no other child would have chosen a color. And you know, as I said, Swami was subtly sending out so many messages to prepare not just the family, but the whole town, the whole village.
These qualities and these traits that he exhibited, you know, endeared him not only to the elders, but to the children also. In fact, this came as a surprising discovery for Kondamma Raju and the other members of the family. What happened was, the Ram Navami was a big festival, and you know, we have already discussed how Kondamma Raju knew the Ramayana by heart. And so naturally this festival celebrating the birth of Lord Rama, Lord Sri Rama, we are again I think somewhere in April 19th or something is Sri Ram Navami this year also. So around this time in the summer it comes, the birth of Lord Rama, birthday of Lord Rama. So during Ram Navami in Puttaparthi there used to be a procession where the statues of Lord Rama would be taken along with the picture, you know, in the cart.
Right.
Then they suddenly noticed that little Satya was missing from home in the night. The procession is on in the village. So they wondered whether he has wandered off somewhere and he has got lost in the crowd. After all, he was a 5-year-old. So there was panic at home and everybody was searching. And to their surprise, greatest surprise, you know where they found little Satya? Little Satya was seated in the cart that was carrying the statues, the picture of the Lord. And he was by the side of this picture.
It was like he was also being worshipped along with the...
It means picture. In the sense, though not consciously being worshipped, but he is right next to the picture and so whatever worship is poured onto the picture, he also receives it. And when they were surprised and they saw this, all the other little children, you know what they said? Yes, means the other children, they used to be very happy with this procession. Because it's something fun, something different, lot of sound, lot of, you know, some fireworks here and there. So run along with that. So they asked the children, why is Satya not running along with you guys? You know, he should be with you people, right? They said, no, he should sit there. Why? Because he is Guru. At an age of 5.5, when many children don't even know the meaning of Guru and maybe not, don't even know that term. Because the term Guru, which refers to teacher, you're introduced to a teacher when you join first grade in when you're 6-year-old, before that it's only kindergarten and it's... Here were children who had already recognized him as a guru. And that, I think that is something that has never left him ever since. Even today, he is the Jagat Guru, the Sadguru for millions around the earth. And I think Prem, we had decided to speak so much. We decided some part of the story till where we will discuss today. We have nowhere near that point. Because the Lord's story is such. As we start speaking about it, as we start narrating it and enjoying it, we come across so many lanes and by lanes into which we can go and it's all a pleasurable experience. Dear listeners, at this point where the elders and the children in the, even the children, you know, the innocent children in the village have recognized our little Satya as Guru, we stop the narrative. We hope to take this up the next to next week. That is, we hope to make this a fortnightly.
Or maybe we will leave that. Let's decide that on the basis of the feedback. We really don't know how you enjoyed this satsang, dear listeners. Arvind, it was, you know, Keats used to say, a thing of beauty is a joy forever. I think Swami's story is like that. It is not something which anybody of us can be bored of. But what we have to see is, are people getting bored of our narrative?
Dear listeners, hope that our narrative has not bored you, because frankly speaking, both Prem and myself have enjoyed ourselves here, reliving the story so beautifully. If you would like us to stick to only topics of discussion of practical use in the world as we were doing, please do let us know. We will have the satsang by ourselves without the mic.
If you want us to continue the story even next week, you know, for the sake of continuity and for the sake of being able to perceive the flow better, we leave it to your choice based on the feedback. Otherwise, as Arvind suggested, we would...
What we are planning to do is
week.
Every alternate week, so that 1 week we have the story, the next week we again go into Swami's teachings, the next week we continue with the story. So every fortnight, that means twice a month at least, we will be reliving his story, which is really history, which we all should know and know it, you know, by heart, totally, in the perfect timeline, because it is such a sweet, lovely, beautiful story. So... having started something new, ventured upon this with love and gratitude to our Lord, we definitely await feedback. And as always, you can write to us at listener@radiosai.org. We'll be eager to read your mails. And let's hope, Prem, that by Swami's grace, our narrative has not marred his stupendous glory and beautiful story.
Yes, dear listeners, we thank you for your company and we thank Swami for this opportunity to drink once again the nectar of his lovely story. We're going to leave you with a beautiful song, a sports meet song from the year 2007. And the other end of the song, you'll be joined by Brother Chandu with his other beautiful program, Love to Love. So, till we meet next week in next afternoon satsang, this is Arvind and Prem taking your leave and offering our pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet.
कदमों में तेरे जन्नत है
वादियों के फूलों का हमसे ये कहना है
चंदा और तारों का तू है खुदा
जहाँ भी ढूंढे हम तू है समा नफरत मिटा दे दिल से रोशनी लेके तेरे दर से दिल जला दे दिल में आदर हासम अपरूप तेजम ये दिव्य बेली गिंतु आशीरूपम